Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, Alexander Christie Miller. The journalist and now author has a new book, To the City, exploring the past and present of a place he called home for nearly a decade, Istanbul. Joining Alex to talk about it is Hannah Lucinda Smith, Turkey correspondent for The Times and Monocle. She's the author of books including Erdogan Rising, which follows the ascent to power of Turkey's strongman leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Let's join Hannah now with more.
Alexander Christie Miller, who is correspondent for The Times of London, based in Istanbul between 2010 and 2017. And his work has also appeared in Newsweek, The Atlantic, Der Spiegel, and The White Review, among other publications. He's also the author of To the City, Life and Death Along the Ancient Walls of Istanbul, which is out now. And we're going to be discussing that book and its themes today. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. So, first of all, I think we should talk about the theme of your book, which is the walls of Istanbul, the ancient walls that guarded what was once Constantinople and still exist today. They surround the kind of historic peninsula in Istanbul. They surround some of the most, well, the most famous attractions in the city, places like the Hagia Sophia, Topkapi Palace, the Blue Mosque. But hardly anybody who comes to Istanbul goes to visit them, and there are reasons for that. Can you talk a bit about why you think the walls are this kind of neglected part of Istanbul and why you chose to write a book about them?
So really the thing that drew me to the walls was, I mean, I remember walking the length of the walls for the first time in about 2012, and, you know, they're this huge structure. They stretch for 4 miles, enclosing the old, you know, historic peninsula of the city. They're about sort of 200 feet wide from the inside of the inner wall to the outside of the former moat. And they are this incredibly dilapidated place. And what really struck me is that it was this dilapidation, which is what drew me to them. Because living in Istanbul, you know, as you yourself know very well, there's this sense of constant change. You know, that during the time I was living there, there was sort of massive political change, social change, you know, economic deterioration, environmental change, and just this constant change in the actual urban fabric of the city itself. You know, stuff is always being knocked down, stuff is always being built. And to see this structure, which is so ancient, you know, the walls were built about sort of 1600 years ago, roughly, and that were built themselves to resist catastrophic change in the form of invading armies that would sack the city. And to see them still existing after such a long time, I thought was, to me, captured something of the spirit of Istanbul, in that it is this place where stuff is always changing, and yet it has this kind of ancient presence as well. And it really came to also epitomize really the theme of the stories of the characters in the book, because the characters in the book are all people who are in different ways are trying to endure through that change that's going on in Turkey, the various kinds of change. And to me, the walls sort of symbolize that. And in terms of why they're so dilapidated, I mean, what's interesting to me is that as a result of their scale, I think it would be difficult for any, even a very well-functioning, stable and smooth society to undertake the job of restoring them to a condition in which they would be a good tourist attraction. I mean, maybe I could just paint a little picture of, you know, what it's like around the walls. And it is like, it's very, the neighborhoods around them are generally very poor. There's quite a lot of crime. There's a lot of drug dealing and stuff going on actually inside and around the walls. And, you know, they're not a particularly safe place. And, you know, the task of making them into a attractive tourist attraction would be massive, would require a kind of political stability through, you know, the municipality and the government and different people working together over a long period of time, which hasn't really existed in Istanbul. And it would also require something to be sort of monetizable at the end of it. And whereas something like the Hagia Sophia, you can sort of charge people entry, it's kind of harder to see how really how you could monetize the walls to a degree that would make them worthwhile to restore. So there are kind of practical reasons, I think, why they're in the state they're in. But fundamentally, they were this very, you know, evocative place to me that captured something about Istanbul, which I wanted to explore. So, yeah, that's what drew me to them.
Yeah, I think that monetization point is a really, really interesting one. And, you know, Hagia Sophia, of course, in, I think, was it 2020 or 2021, President Tayyip Erdogan turned Hagia Sophia from a museum, which charged entry, into a mosque, hugely symbolic. Obviously, it became very, very popular, crowded every Friday prayers. But at some point, they realized the amount of money that they were losing actually through tourism income because they were no longer charging entry. And just recently, they announced that for non-Muslims, for people who aren't going to go and pray there, there's going to be an entry charge again. So I think, you know, that's a really, really interesting point. Thinking back, this is a really disgraceful thing to admit because I've been here for a long time, but I've never walked the walls in their entirety. And I think that's probably true for a lot of people living in Istanbul. And just casting my mind back, the only time that I can really remember the walls being sort of used in any way is either, you know, on the kind of on the anniversary of the conquest of Istanbul, or it was when political posters were hung on them. I think it was the 2015 elections. There were sort of big posters for President Erdogan's party hung on them. But generally, they're just kind of forgotten and dilapidated and, as you say, quite dangerous.
Yeah, it's interesting because they are, you know, they do occupy actually quite an important place in the sort of Turkish national, you know, imagination, because they were the site of the great victory of, you know, of Mehmet the Conqueror, Fatih Sultan Mehmet. And it's almost like, you know, as you say, they use them during the anniversary of the conquest. They're almost like a stage on which this thing is reenacted every year of when, you know, Mehmet captured the city in 1453. But the actual setting itself is you know, remains very neglected.
Do you think there's a kind of ideological or political reason for that? Because obviously, you know, like you say, the conquest, you know, 1453, that was, it's kind of seen as the sort of starting point of Istanbul. It was the moment when it became part of the Ottoman Empire, the capital of the Ottoman Empire. But, you know, the walls date back far further to that, to when, you know, it was Constantinople, to the Byzantine period. Do you think that's part of the reason why they are neglected in the way they are?
I think that's definitely an element of it. I mean, you know, in Turkey, there's very much a tendency to view the pre-Turkish architectural heritage as being in some way foreign. And, you know, this doesn't apply to old churches and that sort of thing, which are obviously seen as something that could, you know, they're seen more as something that can be, you know, taken over and converted. But for a structure that was purely military and that was purely secular in its function, it's a symbol of these people who came before. And you know, and in Turkey, it's hard to appreciate sometimes as an outsider the degree to which there's this strain of fear in society over the possibility of these former peoples somehow coming back and claiming, you know, what they believe should still be theirs, even if it seems irrational as an outsider. It's certainly throughout the history of the Turkish Republic, it's been quite an active fear. There's definitely an element to that. Yeah, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned the kind of the scale of the walls, just, you know, how massive they are, and they are really a kind of feat of engineering, particularly for the time that they were built. But the kind of modern structures that not only surround them, they sort of intertwine with them in quite an amazing way. I mean, you'll find sort of, you know, bits of the wall almost built into modern buildings. And as you mentioned, you know, these are mostly very, very poor neighbourhoods. Can you talk a little bit about those neighbourhoods and some of the characters you met? And particularly, who was the most memorable character he met during this book?
So, yeah, I mean, one of the other things that drew me to the walls was when I walked along them, I saw that you have these very old neighbourhoods. You have a lot of old Ottoman wooden houses, which are sort of tumbling down. And you have a mixture of different communities. It's always been an area where immigrants go. And you have sort of Kurdish communities, you have Roma communities, you have, Turkish communities from all over, all over Turkey, and Syrian refugees and other groups. And so it sort of struck me that you can really build up a kind of almost a cross-section of different parts of Turkish society. It's very hard to sort of choose one character. I mean, I think one person who really stuck in my mind as feeling like the heart of the book was this guy who was a Communist Party activist, and his sort of trajectory over the course of the several years in which I was following the different people living around the walls. He started off very inspired, very politically engaged. He'd been inspired by the 2013 protests that broke out over Gezi Park and which were this sort of huge protest against Erdogan's government. And then gradually over the years, his kind of political energy was sapped by the sort of infighting between different sections on the left and the kind of pressure being put on him by the authorities. And by the end, he'd sort of seemed to have quit politics and said, well, I've got a kid now and I need to settle down. I need to keep quiet. His trajectory seemed to me quite emblematic of the way in which Turkey's politics have headed, really. Having said that, you know, there were other people whose stories developed in very different ways. You know, one of the things that I did was I tried to choose people who just seemed to me like people who were sympathetic and honest and had something to say, rather than immediately having some extraordinary story, by and large. And then I just sort of followed them over time and just saw how things unfolded. And I think probably, in terms of what it, what I took from it more than anything else, is it just sort of deepened my love of Turkey, and just following these people and seeing how their lives developed over a long period of time. It just gave me a huge amount of admiration for people's perseverance and endurance through pretty difficult times.
Yeah, I mean, we've both worked as newspaper correspondents in Turkey, in fact, for the same newspaper. And, you know, it's a feature of, doing that kind of daily news that you tend to go out and look for your character, right? You have the story that you want to do and you go out and you look for the character who's going to be able to tell that story best or speak to the themes of that story best. And it's, quite rare that you can do what you've done in this book and just go and talk to people, not necessarily about a certain issue or not for a certain end, but just to find out about their lives. So it feels like a really long time ago that you first mentioned your idea for this book to me, and a lot has happened in Turkey since then. And a lot has happened for you as well. You were living here at the time that you started, quite soon after you left to go back to the UK, but obviously you were coming back a lot, doing the research, also for personal reasons. Can you talk a bit about how Turkey changed, both politically and also for you personally, during the period that you were writing?
So yeah, the book came about in a very odd way, in that quite soon after I started researching it, I moved back to England, and then was visiting and doing sort of research trips. And so it was, odd because in a way I was far less au fait with the day-to-day political side of stuff, which I've been very closely following, you know, when I was in the country. And so really my sense of the country was very much filtered through these few neighborhoods around the city walls. And, you know, there was a very keen sense that I had over the course of the time I was there of the economic deterioration going on, of the worsening economic situation and the increasing hardship that people were under. You know, politically, I mean, you know, that there was obviously, you know, things sort of went back and forth. I mean, I felt like really the dramatic changes. I mean, I'd be interested to hear your view on this, because obviously you've been in Turkey during that time. But the dramatic changes that took place to me were really the ones almost preceding the time in which I was researching the book, where you had, you know, the coup attempts, you had the Gezi protests, you had the Syrian civil war, you had this fight between the Gulenist movement, the Gulen movement, and the government. And really the book was covering that period, whilst also looking at the sort of individual lives of the people after it, if you see what I mean. What was interesting to me was that I found that after being in Turkey for a long time, getting to know the country better, and also, you know, marrying into a Turkish family, I'd become increasingly ambivalent about my own my confidence in my own views on the country, and you know, there's a sort of certain, you know, there's a sort of certain tone of authority that you're expected to project as a foreign correspondent, and you know, news desks want a kind of a strong take on things. And you're encouraged to, you know, as a matter of necessity, you sort of boil stuff down to these broad social groups and that sort of thing. And as you're saying earlier, you know, you talk to people who seem to illustrate a particular political viewpoint. I was sort of doing something that was kind of, I guess, almost the opposite of that.
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's almost kind of like the foreign correspondence paradox, right? Like the longer that you live in a place, the better you understand it and the better that you understand its nuances and the better equipped you are in one sense to be a foreign correspondent. But you also get kind of closer to the story. You, of course, develop friendships. In your case, also in mine, develop relationships, you know, almost Turkish family, you're almost joining Turkish families, you know, seeing things from a different point of view. And it becomes quite difficult to be as kind of decisive about your judgments. But I think that's the beauty of writing a book compared to doing daily journalism is, you know, there is room for those nuances. And I think, you know, one of the topics where there is very little room for nuance in daily news or in newspaper journalism is the topic of Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And, you know, he's seen, I think, from the outside as almost, you know, in the same category as somebody like Vladimir Putin, you know, a kind of, you know, out and out election frauding dictator. And as we both know, it's far more complicated than that. You know, no matter the mistakes he's made, no matter, you know, more than mistakes, the kind of bad things he's done, no matter, you know, the direction the country's going in and the strength of the opposition against him, he continues to win elections. Just talk a bit about what your characters in your book taught you about the reasons for that.
So it was interesting because over the course of you know, following the different people in the book who sort of span the political spectrum, the one thing that I really came to notice is how the people who were on the sort of anti-government side of it became progressively more demoralized as a result of, you know, the repression that they were facing, sort of police harassment, court cases being opened against them. You know, one Kurdish guy I was following ended up fleeing the country and going to America. But there was also a notable diminishing of the enthusiasm of the people on the pro-government side as well. I mean, perhaps the most striking story was one guy who I met who was an AKP, you know, Erdogan's party activist. And one of the things that had driven him or you know, which had made him so supportive of them was the fact that his mother had this terrible spinal injury. And before the AKP came to power, she had languished in a hospital for years in a state hospital without getting any proper treatment. And then the AKP came to power and they reformed the healthcare system. And suddenly, you know, the quality of her treatment improved. And this was a very clear and tangible reason why, you know, or example of the kind of stuff they did in their early years that really made them, you know, very popular. And over the course of the time I was writing the book, he actually changed his views and became increasingly disillusioned. He began to feel that they'd lost their way, you know, they'd achieved all these positive things they set out to do. And then they were then just kind of, you know, had lost their sort of purpose. And he actually ended up voting for the CHP in the last presidential elections and voting for, you know, the CHP candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. And that was interesting to me because this guy was from Kahramanmaraş, which was the epicenter of the terrible earthquakes that happened last year. And he, you know, I sort of said to him, like, how come it is that where you know, in this episode, at this place, which had been so badly hit, and where, you know, the government had been heavily criticized for the shortcomings of its response, the population had still voted overwhelmingly for Erdogan. And he was sort of said something which tallied with something which other people had said to me, which was that, even though things are getting worse and even though the economic situation is really bad, basically people, he almost made it sound like sort of gamblers at a casino who were sort of, you know, putting their just trying for one last go to try and make things back. You know, people find it very hard to imagine after all this time and after the kind of extent of the government's control of the media message, they find it hard to imagine anyone else running the country better or providing any kind of stability. So they're sort of clinging onto them. And the other thing is that, you know, the AKP have developed this kind of charity-based model of social outreach and political activism. You know, one of the things that this same guy was telling me about was how when his family moved to Istanbul, the local AKP municipality was sending free care packages to his mother because she was disabled, and they do this stuff. And we both know from our reporting that, you know, this kind of charitable activism is supported by a whole business wing where they have friendly businesses who give them free stuff in return for political favors. And this model is very powerful, and it almost becomes more powerful as people become more desperate. So, you know, a lot of people thought that he might have lost this election, which happened last year, because of the economic situation. But actually, I think, you know, one of the things that I learned from the people I talked to in the book is that model maintains its resilience in the face of certainly economic pressure. So I'd be interested to know what you think on that, because obviously you're following things very much on a day-to-day basis and you're still in Istanbul. But, you know, that's what I took from it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that people outside Turkey need to give him probably more credit than they do. That's not to say that he's doing good things, but in terms of his skill as a campaigner, I mean, he knows the cleavages of the country really well. He knows which buttons to push, particularly to turn the opposition against each other. And I think, you know, for me, one of the reasons for his continuing success is the failure of the opposition, actually. And we saw that again in the general elections last year when basically what seemed to be a pretty sort of solid coalition really fell apart at the first challenge. But we've got elections coming up again in a few weeks. It feels like there's never a year without elections in Turkey. The local elections this time, the big prize for Erdogan is going to be Istanbul, which he lost to the opposition back in 2019. But a really interesting thing that happened, which has gone almost unreported just a few days ago, almost hidden within a press conference that he did with President Zelensky from Ukraine, Erdogan announced that this election is going to be his last. Now, that gives him quite a bit of breathing room because the next elections won't be until 2028. But it's quite an astonishing announcement from a guy who I believed was going to be in power until he died. Do you think that we are coming to the end of the Erdogan era? And if so, what do you think is going to come next? And, you know, coming back to the theme of your book, what do you think that might mean for the walls? Do you think there's any party in Turkey, if they came to power, that might, you know, pay more attention to them, maybe put a bit more money into them, maybe turn them into some kind of tourist attraction in the way that, you know, Topkapi Palace and Hagia Sophia are?
Well, I mean, to answer the last bit of your question first, I mean, the current İmamoğlu-led municipality is actually doing a pretty big project on the walls at the moment. And, you know, they've restored several towers. They're restoring more. They've opened up this visitor center. So I'd actually say there were some very, very bad repairs done by Bedrettin Dalan, the Istanbul mayor, during the 1980s, I think. Since then, there's been very little been done, but these are by far the most extensive repairs that have been done since then. So really, I mean, if the CHP lose power now in Istanbul, as you know, it seems like they may very well do, those repairs might come to an end. I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I find it hard to imagine any party mustering up more political will to repair the walls than than the current one is doing. You know, not that they're doing anything, you know, it's not a complete restoration, but I think, you know, there might be a continuation of that program. But the problem is that even if they did carry on doing that, there's, you still have the fact that they're very poor neighborhoods around them, and the potential to restore them is kind of limited by that as well. And that's a much more entrenched problem. And, you know, who knows what will happen with that. So going back to, you know, Erdogan and his future, it's extraordinary to me that no one has commented more on this announcement that he made. Probably people outside Turkey probably view it quite cynically in terms of like, well, he's going to say that, but you know, how often has Putin said that he might, you know, I don't know. I think people probably don't take him at his word. I think the fact that you or I would find it more interesting is because, you know, we know anecdotally for a long time that Erdogan is not in great health. And so while I would never predict the end of the Erdogan era because so many people have done it before, and you know, he's always confounded people. I do think that there's this strong sense among people following, you know, Turkish politics closely that he's not in the best of health, and he's probably not going to be someone who's going to go on and on forever. So in terms of when that might happen and what it might look like, you know, that's obviously a much bigger question. I mean, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that as well, and before giving mine. So,
I think the timing might be slightly cynical. I think, you know, we are coming up to these local elections. He's very keen for his party to take Istanbul back. And as you know as well, his people, the people around him, are always very vexed when he's described as an autocrat or a dictator. And what they usually say is, well, if he was a dictator, you couldn't call him a dictator. And I think this is probably going to be used in that way. Well, if he was a dictator, then he wouldn't announce that he's stepping down. But I think, you know, the interesting thing is going to be what happens next. And I think, you know, this is kind of like firing a starting gun on the succession plan, because I can't see him leaving without, you know, an heir to hand over to. But who that's going to be, I think, is going to be an interesting question for the months ahead. But thank you, Alexander Christie Miller, for a fascinating conversation. Thank you even more for writing your book, which is highly recommended. It's beautifully written. It's deeply informative. Its name again is To the City, Life and Death Along the Ancient Walls of Istanbul. And it's available now from your local bookshop. I'm Hannah Lucinda Smith, and you've been listening to Intelligence Squared.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by myself, Connor Boyle, and edited by Tom Hall. If you want to keep up with everything going on at Intelligence Squared, sign up to the newsletter. Head over to intelligencesquared.com to get the heads up on all our live events coming up. And members can also peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds. That's all over at intelligencesquared.com.